For generations, we've been with our customers through every season of life, helping families, ranchers, and businesses thrive. Hi, this is Pam with First Northern Bank of Wyoming. From local lending to personalized service, we're proud to be your community bank and trusted partner. Whether you're opening your first account, growing your business, or buying your dream home, we're here for you. First Northern Bank of Wyoming, proudly serving Wyoming since 1885. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS number 402576.
January holds a secret, a fire hidden beneath winter's deepest cold. It's called Garnet, January's gemstone. It's long been associated with protection, passion, strength, and lasting friendship, making it a meaningful choice for gifts. At Legacy Diamond and Gems in Sheridan, see garnets already designed for purchase or speak with their experts to craft a piece as unique as the stone itself. Jewelry forged in winter, worn forever, a legacy. Legacy Diamond and Gems, 11 North Main Street in Sheridan, online at LegacyDiamondGems.com.
Oh man, thank you for bringing the food.
No worries.
I got a hold of Big Horny and grabbed everything.
Oh,
you called who?
Big Horny.
Famous wings.
Shrimp cocktail.
House-made chips and dips to die for.
Oh, and Hetty's pizzas.
You mean the Big Horn Y.
Wow, you have more to bring in?
Let me help.
You know it, girl.
Beer, wine, and mixers.
This is the big game.
Thanks to Big Horny, we're doing it right.
That's Big Horn Y. Unfortunate Facebook address. Unforgettable food.
This is Public Pulse, your information and conversation program, brought to you by First Federal Bank and Trust. You can voice your opinion by calling 672-KROE. That's 672-5763. Now, your host for Public Pulse, Floyd Whitey.
Wednesday, January 21st. From the foot of the Bighorns in Wyoming's Emerald City, I'm Floyd Whiting, and this is Public Pulse. This morning, we are joined by Sheridan Police Department Chief Travis Koltiska and Captain Tom Ringley. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome back.
Morning, Floyd. Thank you.
Now, real quick question. We were talking about the wind before the show. Does the SPD have to handle any fallout from major wind events this year? Property damage, car accidents, things like that?
Other than picking up fallout from the branches,
yeah,
no, because when there's accidents, like if a vehicle's a branch falls on it, it's not a car accident.
Okay.
That's not considered a car accident. Even a branch or a tree falling over on people's property, not reportable. It's not a police report. It's a call them an act of God, just like the insurance company does, yeah. Unfortunately. And where we usually get involved is if there is downed. Rather, it's down power lines from branches that are hitting power lines have come down, or the lines slapping together and causing outages. Or if there's just anything that's caused a road hazard, you know, we'll go and provide, either tell somebody to get it removed if we can't remove it ourselves. That's about the extent of the police involvement in any of these major storms. Whether that's a snow or ice, heavy snow or ice storm or wind or whatever, if it's an act of God, we're just there to make sure that everybody's safe and secure.
I imagine the wind doesn't do too much to the vehicles in the city, whereas most speeds around town are 30 miles or less.
Mm-hmm.
It probably really cuts down on any fender benders or gusts of wind blowing somebody.
Yeah, we don't have any blowovers like you see on clips, videos of semis going down I-80 and getting blown over. When I lived in Wheatland, just a few miles south there, Bordeaux exit, they blew over there all the time. But no, thankfully in Sheridan, we don't deal with that. Knock on wood.
Knock on wood.
I don't want our first one to be happening soon.
Agreed. Now, the last time you appeared, we spoke on the levels of use of force, and we did promise we would cover the numbers from the 2025 year. Before we get into tactics, Captain, there's one thing that you always like to send to me, and that is take this into consideration for context. So that is how I'd like to kind of start this out. How many total calls for service did the SPD handle in 2025? And how does that number frame the use of force discussion?
Well, not only did we answer 10,663, to be specific, calls for service, but we also conducted 5,686 traffic stops, issued 783 citations, arrested 275 people on warrants, and also made 462 custodial arrests that resulted from investigations. So out of all those numbers, our officers only used force 15 times.
That's,
and let's take into context from the last, our last show when we talked about what force was. We're not talking about handcuffing people. We're not talking about guiding people from one point to another or officer presence. We're talking about intermediate uses of forces and higher. So that would be a baton strike, pepper spray, a taser, a knee or elbow type strike, and any force higher than that. So, and those 15 specific incidents, some of are contained in some investigations required more than one reportable use of force at a time. So out of all those numbers, it is 15 times.
So the majority of the time, professional presence really kind of pays off.
Professional presence and professionalism. Too, let's not forget the officer's communication and demeanor and the verbiage that they use.
And I imagine it's probably different in other areas, but from what I've seen and from our discussions, people around here pretty good about, you know, if an officer says, hey, I need you to just stand up on the curb, please let me handle this situation. I don't really need your involvement too much. They're pretty compliant.
Oh, overwhelmingly they are. That is, again, that stems from several things. That stems from, like the captain said, communication skill. I often said that, your mouth is your deadliest weapon. It can either get you in the worst amount of trouble or get you out of trouble. And in my youth, guilty, right? Occasionally, I just said things that I probably shouldn't have that fired people up. So if we're interacting in a professional manner and communicating with them, being respectful, we almost always get the same response in return. We are able to react accordingly based off the reaction we get from individuals. And if we don't do something to set them off, then it's almost always a positive outcome or a positive result.
Now, when we say custodial arrest, for individuals out there, they may not understand what that means. What is a custodial arrest?
It means that's when people go to jail.
Okay.
There's a difference between detainment, which is a limited seizure, and custody, which is a full seizure. We're detaining someone. It's just for a minute. Hey, sit here so I can talk to you. And a detainment can turn into custody, but custody is what we're talking about in this instance, is people going to jail.
Okay. Now, officers used empty hand techniques 5 times last year. What types of situations typically lead to those encounters?
Those are most often passive resistive, trying to flee, trying to get away, trying to pull away from the officers. It results in some sort of, having to use some sort of physical restraint above and beyond just a handcuff, whether it's an arm bar, whether it's just, controlling their movements. So that's traditionally when an empty hands, it's the individual is not attempting to assault the officer. And then so that they can, the passive resistance, the flee or escape or just try to pull away.
We got a runner.
Yeah. Yeah. Oftentimes that's probably the most common need for an empty hands technique.
Now, OC spray, only used twice in 2025. What does that tell you about how often resistance escalated beyond verbal or hands-on type of control?
Well, both the OC and the taser, which we only used once for full deployment, they're not used to gain compliance, say, to get people in a car. Or it is when they are presenting the intent to fight us. So if someone's standing there raising bald fists or they're blading off their stance, or saying, no, I'm going to, giving this verbal indications that they want to fight. We're not paid to fight fair.
Yeah.
We're not fighting anyway. We're controlling people. That's when we deploy it, the pepper spray or taser.
Within your, both of you have been doing this job for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Within that amount of time, the use of non-lethal tools, we can call them. I don't know what you address them as officially, has kind of evolved through the years. Was it already well in use when you both put on the shield?
To an extent, when we were hired, there was a step-by-step use of force continuum to where the officers were, it would progress from verbal presence to verbal commands to empty hands, to intermediate, to deadly. But now, actually, quite some time ago, it's been recognized that these situations are so rapidly evolving. Sometimes you can go from professional presence to a show of force with a firearm back down to verbal commands. It just depends on the level of compliance of the people we're controlling.
So like an ROE, a rule of engagement, you can go from one to four.
Yes.
If the situation called for it.
You don't have to go step by step.
It's a fluid list, not one that you have to stick to rigidly.
Yeah. And you were asking too about, you know, I understood the advent of technology in the less lethal realm. I mean, that has changed drastically over the years as well. So when you add in stuff like beanbag rounds, they're a direct impact round fired from either a shotgun or a 40 millimeter launcher. Or you add a taser in, those things all factor into the use of force. I still want to throw back to call it a continuum because that's how I was trained, but it's not a continuum to your decision matrix when you're talking about because of the other tools that are available to us. When I started, now beanbags were brand new, not reliable, not designed the way they should be. You know, they weren't necessarily should have been. So the technology has changed and the advancement of those have increase their capabilities and capacities. There was no such thing as a taser. Well, there were the old stun guns that you could buy down at Ace Hardware back in the day, but there weren't the law enforcement tasers that fired projectiles that had the same capabilities. So technology has advanced greatly in our careers as far as less than lethal, because they can still cause significant injuries.
Yeah.
And so you have to take all that into consideration when you're making a decision on what level of force is necessary in this situation.
When it comes to the training with the tasers, because that technology has come quite far.
Ways. Yeah.
I don't know what model it is, but it has essentially the same kind of pistol hold.
Yes.
That your weapons do. So you're very comfortable with the handholds. And then if I remember correctly, the cartridge out front can be discharged.
Yeah, they're removable. From when we started with the first tasers, it was a single cartridge on the front. The ones we have now have dual cartridges. They're called an X2, so you actually have two cartridges there. Now tasers come out with a Taser 10. Well, they did a Taser 7 in the meantime. Now a Taser 10 that has, I don't even know how many times that they can be fired without having to change a cartridge.
Wow.
So even within the taser, that technology has changed then from battery capabilities. I mean, they're constantly evolving and constantly changing all the time. So,
what's the training on those? Quite extensive?
It's a 6-hour class, plus you have to go through drills. Plus we also do annual refreshers of at least 2 hours, again, with drills, under stress, firing cartridges. Every one of our officers that carries a taser has been struck with a taser, has experienced what it's like. It's not fun, I can tell you that. I was an instructor, so I got hit 4 times in my career. I won't sign up for that again. But because it's just anytime you use any sort of level of force, it's a stressful situation. There's a lot of different factors going on right now. So we train our officers under stress in scenarios to teach them the deployment of that taser in the proper method and means of doing so.
The amount of adrenaline involved in an encounter can be amazing. And I know a lot of people, you know, automatically go to the idea that, wow, it makes you quicker, it makes you this, it makes you that. But you have to kind of pull back from that as an officer of the law.
That's why we train. That's why we put our officers in situations that are training situations. So they've experienced it before. And so they are able to have better control when that adrenaline is running through your body. I mean, that's a physiological function that nobody can control. You can't just tell yourself, I'm shutting the adrenaline off. But how you react while that adrenaline is pumping through you, we go through training progressions so that they've experienced them and they know that they can, you know, they can handle the situations accordingly and react and behave in a manner that's proper and necessary for what we're trying to accomplish.
And it's not all training too. It's the real life reps.
Yeah.
Are just, if not more beneficial, because that there you really find what works. Final word on the taser is it's not a magic button. It's not a magic pill. It's a tool that can fail or fail is the wrong word. It may not be operable, especially in a place where people wear thick Carhartt type jackets. If people are wearing a lot of thick clothes or loose and baggy clothes, that the probes may not connect. So it's just a tool. It's not like on TV where people go unconscious. It immobilizes you for 5 seconds and then you're good to go. So we also train people to recognize that what to do when the tools don't are not completely effective.
But I guess it was probably over 20 years ago now. We were given instruction on the less than lethal tools as well. And we had a few go through the taser. That is a heck of a thing to see. You can see all kinds of videos online about it, but it is true. It doesn't knock people out. I thought for sure that it would cause the body to...
Neuromuscular interruption.
Yeah. It simply kind of incapacitates you.
Yeah. Yeah. TV Land, I've seen that multiple times on movies where somebody gets used to the taser and they're out for 30 minutes, right? Unconscious. No. not even close. It's like a big muscle cramp.
Chief, what significance do you place on the fact that there were no baton strikes in 2025?
Well, I think, again, that's just the totality of everything, our interactions. It showed that that was not a necessary tool. I mean, that was the decisions that the officers were making at that time. That wasn't necessary. We do have other options, for one. You get with a baton, you got to close the distance pretty close to be able to make an effective baton strike. So if there is somebody that's being very aggressive or has indicated their will to fight and they have said, rather for whatever reason, whether it's verbal or their, nonverbal cues that are turning off, closing that distance and closing that gap at that point, the officers perceive that to be probably too dangerous. Could have used either that's could have accounted for the one taser or the two, pepper spray incidents that occurred
there. There's been maybe 5 in the last 25 years.
Wow.
Every time I've used
it, I can't think of one.
I've used it at the end of it to hit a major muscle nerve bundle to get compliance, which I can do with an elbow or fist or whatever. But as far as fully expanded baton strikes, it may have been 5. It's partly we go through so many training reps with it. I would want no part of a baton strike. I would much rather get tased or pepper sprayed.
Yeah.
It's serious force. And like the chief said, it's a fantastic tool. We actually use it to pry arms from underneath people more than anything. But the new tools, they let us maintain that gap.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't understand that. I want you at a distance.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to the ground with you. That's a dangerous, dangerous situation for a law enforcement officer. By the time you hit that, we're in some trouble. So anything to keep you away from the officer is the best. How does the absence of deadly force incidents in 2025 compare to what departments of similar size may have experienced in other states, other areas? I know you can't speak for them, but... what does it say?
I don't know that we're abnormal from any other agency the same size of us in the country. It really, again, there's so many different factors that figure into that. And looking back in 2025, 2025 had the lowest number of officers killed in the line of duty since 1937, I think. Below 100 for the first time in a long, long time. I don't know if that's a shift in people's feelings about law enforcement. I know there's been several, I get notifications via email weekly of officers killed in the line of duty. And I know it continues to happen, unfortunately. But again, those situations, the one when deadly force would have been, justified for an officer to use. And if we've had a lower number of officers killed, then I would say that's definitely probably a lower number of officers needing to use deadly force.
Our use of deadly force is completely the decision of the suspect. So just for a town our size, it depends if that suspect's in town.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it would be the same for other jurisdictions. It's just like, it's not like we have a deadly force quota that we want to use. It's, we are... Well, there is, it's 0. But any use of force in Sheridan, it's the decision of the suspect to how much force we have to use.
Captain, in the paperwork that you got to me, there was, I believe, like a traffic stop that turned a little bit more serious. Do we have any details on that? How did that escalate?
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Floyd.
Oh, I apologize. Maybe I read something wrong there, Captain.
Yeah.
We'll just move on to the next one. Can you explain to us how the department tracks and defines a use of force incident for reporting purposes itself?
We investigate every use of force beyond the level of from a strike, whether knee or elbow, on up, all the way to a firearm. And also, we investigate shows of force. So if we draw our weapon to control someone, or we draw, we expand a baton, or we brandish our tasers, we investigate and document all of that. We have a program, a performance monitoring program called Guardian Tracking, to where we enter all the use of force investigations. We investigate everything. So we can, the Guardian Tracking will, if there's a pattern emerging, it will send us an alert. If one officer's used too much, a certain number, I think four uses of, reported use of force in 6 months, it has sent a warning to us, a notice. So we go back and review everything. And it could just be that officer was on night shifts a lot. But we investigate everything. People would be surprised how much we investigate every little complaint. If we handcuff someone, that's not something we investigate. If we guide someone from point A to point B by the arm, we don't. But if we use a strike on a major nerve bundle, then yeah we would. We investigate everything, and it's documented. Those reports are subject to state retention laws, so they automatically purge after a certain amount of time. And that's what we do.
And one thing that I always say right about this time is it all begins with the first step of hiring for character.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it truly begins. On that, I got to take a quick commercial break. More with the Sheridan Police Department when we return. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM. Sheridan.
Some banks answer to shareholders.
First Federal Bank and Trust answers to the community.
Because as a mutual bank, everyone benefits. Profits stay local.
Supporting nonprofits and community programs with decades of local roots and modern online and mobile banking that fits your life.
More than a bank.
A mutual commitment.
First Federal Bank and Trust. Member FDIC.
Winter has finally arrived. Hi, this is Sarah Ridenour at Sheridan Honda. We are offering exclusive snow day savings. Every day there is snow on the ground in Sheridan, all automotive customers at Sheridan Honda will receive 10% off the total cost of their repairs, parts, and labor. Don't want to drive in the snow? Well, we'll pick up your vehicle and deliver it back to your home. Call Sheridan Honda and Power Sports to get your snow day savings today.
You're invited to the 9th Annual Little Goose Ranch Production Sale, January 24th at Buffalo Livestock Marketing. Selling is an outstanding set of registered yearling Black Angus bulls and replacement heifers, featuring progeny influenced by top-name sires such as Coleman Charlo, Ellingson Statement, SAV Certified, and other outstanding herd sires. Free wintering and delivery within 500 miles. Visit littlegooseranch.com for further information and to see the catalog. Make plans for Buffalo, Wyoming, January 24th at 1 p.m. for the Little Goose Ranch production sale.
Step into a world of wintry wonder as Shimmer brings a breathtaking Cirque performance to the Weill Theater stage tonight at 6:30. Enjoy awe-inspiring aerialists, acrobats, and dreamlike choreography, celebrating the enchantment of the season through movement, light, and imagination. Tickets for this spellbinding experience are available now at the Weill Theater box office or online at weilltheater.com. A Winter Cirque Reverie, tonight at the YL Theater.
Good morning. Welcome back to Public Pulse. I'm your host, Floyd Whiting. And this morning, we're speaking with Sheridan Police Department Chief Travis Koltiska, Captain Tom Ringley. Now, we're talking about the use of force numbers for 2025. And Captain, how many incidents resulted in our officers being injured? And what level of injuries did our officers receive last year?
We had two incidents, and they were sprains. Nothing above the level of sprain. And then we had one more incident where an officer got his hand caught up in a tool, and it was damaged for a little bit. So overall, we're pretty low. And then we've had zero incidents of suspects being hurt beyond abrasions and bruises, which are a result of them struggling with us, say a head rubbing on them. Asphalt or something like that. But as far as injuries, there have been none to suspects and some minor ones to our people.
Chief, from the training perspective, what does that tell you about your programs up there? No serious bodily injuries suffered from the officers or suspects?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the fact that there's only 15 out of 20,000 plus contacts, you know, 15 use of force necessary completely, you know, that's tells me great things that there's good communication going on, that the officers are well trained and they're being professional and out there on the street. The fact there's no injuries, there's always potential for injury, even when you are training. I've seen probably as many injuries in training situations as anything. So the fact that the we train properly, use the correct techniques, they're designed to obviously take control with the least amount of potential for injury as possible. But there's just some things that are just kind of unavoidable. And so it tells me that they're utilizing the techniques correctly. They're being safe for themselves and those around them. And so that's a very positive outlook.
Now, of the 15 show of force incidents, how many involved firearms during calls for service, sir?
We had six. There was firearms only during a call for service. We had one, and that's brandished. One when executing an arrest warrant, and then three for high-risk traffic stops, which we figured out that's what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
on the show.
I apologize for and that. A
high-risk traffic stop is when we're stopping someone. It's usually a stolen car or a car that may have a high risk arrest warrant.
The vehicle in it.
Yeah. So when you see like two cars blocking the roadway, parked roughly side by side, people yelling commands, people getting out of the officers yelling commands, people getting out of the stop vehicle, laying down in the street, getting that's a high risk stop. You know, one of the most common questions we get is why do we always have two police cars on a traffic stop at night? There's two reasons. One, it's to prevent anyone making us use force on them. And two, for safety, two eyes are better than one. Officers can't see in a car as well at nighttime as they can in the day. And that's standard procedure throughout the country. If you see two officers on a, or more on a stop, it's not because they don't have anything else to do. It's for a reason.
It's standard procedure throughout the nation.
Yeah, maybe not during daylight hours for routine speeding. But obviously at night, the potential for a DUI increases or any other reason.
And obviously that's not very common in our area. We were having kind of a conversation offline when we were determining just exactly what I did get wrong. It kind of shocks me that stolen cars in our area, it happens. I would just think a town this small, you see someone's car and you know them, and you're like, well, that's not Jerry or Rebecca in the driver's seat. What is going on over there?
Well, I mean, we're small, but we're not quite that small. There's still, I mean, it's happened throughout my career, even when I worked in Wheatland. town of 3,500 people. We had stolen vehicles from there as well. I mean, there's multiple reasons. Whether they just take them for a joyride, or they're actually attempting to deprive the owner of the property. It does happen. It continues to happen. We have a impound lot in our back behind the police department that has, I think it's got two stolen vehicles in it right now.
Wow.
So it happens. And it's not always from this jurisdiction, remember, too. We're also finding these vehicles that they travel into our jurisdiction from other areas. They could be stolen from somewhere else, and we are able to locate them. Oftentimes, they're from our own jurisdiction, though.
Wow. That's kind of surprising. Make sure you're locking your doors, folks. Keeps honest people honest. Now, we've already talked about tasers. It's not something I want to go over again. When force is used, which specific types automatically trigger internal review or documentation? And you said anything that involves a strike.
Or higher, yeah. Or a strike or a display of a tool, whether it's a taser, open baton, firearm.
How often do you have somebody from the community come forward and say, that was a strike? And but you look at the video and it doesn't look
well. We generate these reports. It starts with the first line supervisors, which is usually a corporal or a sergeant. They know what happened on scene, or they read it in the report, or they review the body camera footage. They basically make that report that, hey, force was used on this case. And then that report's reviewed by the lieutenants, myself, and the chief. I can't remember the last excessive use of force complaint we've received from the community off the top of my head. But we are the ones generating these reports.
Supervisors.
Yes.
They're reviewing this and they're saying, okay, yeah, we need to go forward with this.
Yeah. And it's just a quick, it's bullet points. It's like, this is what happened. This is why. This is the policy. We're either good to go or we're not, or there's some training points.
You know, yeah, that serves multiple purposes. One is to identify any training gaps, identify any needs for new equipment or tools, identify any kind of policy adjustments that need to be made. So there's all kinds of reasons. And it's just self-accountability. Make sure that we're acting within the parameters of the authority granted to us. So there's lots of reasons to do that.
If anything, the supervisors are submitting reports that aren't required.
Yeah. Mm.
They're erring on the side of caution to make sure even if it was a throw by definition, taking someone to the ground, like with an arm bar, that's not required, but they're still doing it, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Chief, how often, you've been chief for 4 or 5 years now?
A little over five years.
When you look at policy, are you the sole individual who has, for lack of a better term, the authority to change that policy, or is there a process that you have to follow?
Both. We have a process. The lieutenants and the captain review policy. They compare that to national model that was provided to us through a Daigle Law Group. So it's a model that is recognized nationwide as a policy, appropriate policy for law enforcement. So we compare our existing policy to that model policy, make any adjustments to our policy. And we do that review every 2 years to make sure that we're up to date with any kind of trends, current case laws, any kind of changes that the courts have said, well, this used to be okay, but this is not anymore. So every 2 years. So it starts with the lieutenants and the captain going through the policies. Then they send it to me for review. And I am the one that approves or says, no, we need to make a change here or there. Based off of something that I've seen through this automatic review trigger.
That's really interesting. So the process itself comes from kind of the feet on the ground.
Well, it comes from, I mean, that as well as it comes from case law and from national standards. And so that it's a continual review of best practices. And also IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, has model policies as well. We're always getting legal updates. So as there's changes in the laws, as there's changes in case law, we're always making adjustments to our policy to accurately reflect and follow case law and the laws that are enacted.
We're actually lucky because the national policy with Daigle Law Group was was used to base state policy.
Okay.
So it, over the course of 2 years, representatives from about 7 departments in Wyoming developed a state policy template based on national policy to which local jurisdictions can tailor their policies. So things are going to be, should, in theory, can be more consistent within Wyoming.
And very uniform within the state.
And it's, by the time we finish, it's time to start again. I mean, it takes 18 months. I mean,
we have 28 chapters of policy.
Yeah, we generally try to sit down every Friday and review them, but things happen, people are off, holidays happen, calls happen. So it's almost a continuous process, and we don't just wait for a policy to come up. If we have a specific incident that we need to address immediately, then we will look at the policy right then.
How often are you sitting the team down and saying, okay, this policy changed, or are they given that through an email, through a notification?
Oh, we actually have a program that it keeps all our policies, and when there's a change made, it will automatically send it out to the entire department. It'll allow the employees of the department to look at a side-by-side comparison and show exactly what changes are made. So it's a 7-page policy, they can go through, because they've already read and understand the one policy. And then they click a button that says, I have read, understand, and acknowledge the policy. And we have documentation that shows that they have done that.
And once you've read it, I expect you to adhere to it.
When we started, I got two three ring binders about 3 inches thick set down in front of me on a table. And for 2 weeks, I sat at a desk and read policies, two three ring binders. Now it's all digitized, easy to acknowledge and receipt of policies and understanding. We can set up quizzes on them. It's much more efficient.
How often do you do that, just pop quiz policy?
The sergeants actually do most of that at the team level.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they will pick. They will have training, specific team trainings, and they will pick policies and go over it. And they'll have discussions within the teams, and also have quizzing on the policies.
And they also discuss every use of force. A little mini after I hate the term hot wash, but it's a mini after action review. This is what happened, good or bad, or what do we need to improve and sustain, and then. That way they've got immediate feedback. So when they go to the next call, they've got that on their minds.
Like an AAR, having an after-action review.
Super informal, but unless it needs to be formal.
Yeah, unless, exactly. All right, is there anything about policy, about use of force numbers, or anything from our discussion this morning that you would like to add to before I let you go?
If you are in contact with Sheridan Police Department officers, and you feel that you have to resist because you think we're acting wrong or unprofessional, out of the parameters of the law, just comply. Call us later if you want to complain. And you would be amazed at the very, very small things we investigate. And that's very important to us. We investigate all complaints. So we would ask and tell people, comply, and then contact us later if you feel like you've been subject to false arrest or unprofessional behavior.
Okay. Captain, Chief, I appreciate you both taking the time to come in here. Captain, I think this was an excellent suggestion that we split this one up into two shows. Maybe we make that a practice from here going on.
You bet.
Because I feel that we were able to really kind of cover a lot of different things. And I didn't even mean to get into policy, but that's where I ended up. I appreciate both of you and your flexibility. Thank you.
Thanks, Floyd.
Thanks, Floyd.
All right. When we come back, we're going to speak with the mayor of Buffalo. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE. And 103.9 FM, Sheridan.
Ever wonder where your bank's priorities really are?
At First